Did being an English teacher inspire you to learn a second language, Richard?
It probably came the other way, that I learned a second language first, and then I became an English teacher. So I learned Spanish, and I did Spanish in university. And my father was actually an English teacher. So I guess the genes kind of wore off. I've been a trainer for the last 20 odd years, maybe a little bit more. And I've always liked helping people. I've always liked being on the stage, so to speak. And I moved to Barcelona in Spain about 10 years ago, going into my 11th year that I've been here. And what I did start to experience was more and more people were coming to me and saying, can you give me English classes? So that's where my teaching started. So it wasn't that I taught and then said, okay, I'm going to learn a language myself. I had actually learned the language, which I think helps because sometimes you understand then the frustrations and the problems that people have when it comes to learning English in this case.
You definitely understand your students.
I think it really helps. I mean, because you understand pronunciation, you understand the mixing up. I mean, in Spanish, I still get mixed up with because we have to say la and el for if it's feminine, masculine. In some senses, I think English is easier because we just say the book. And it's not that it's a feminine book or a masculine book. It's just a book. In that sense, it's easier. But then there's so many complexities in English that I'm still learning. I'm learning more about English as I teach.
I know English is very vast. And so, yes, that's very interesting.
I always say to my students, what I have found is that my Spanish students will know English grammar better than a native. If I stopped an English speaker in the middle of the street and said, okay, what's the past perfect? I mean, it would be like, huh? But if you use it, they say, oh, yeah, well, I use that. And even for me, you know, after years and years of teaching, I still have to revise before I teach something because, you know, you say, okay, well, yeah, which tense is that? It's very difficult for us as native speakers to understand that. But the same happens to me. I would ask people in Spanish, okay, why did you use that construction? And the answer usually is because that's the way it is.
Learning those various complexity with English and having to use it naturally, especially if it's those like intricate parts, is difficult.
I think that's the key, just what you said. They're using it naturally because at the moment, with some of my students, I'm going through phrasal verbs, which is something that everybody hates because it's difficult to be able to use something naturally. Or idioms. How do I use those? Because I always say to my students, it's better to learn three idioms this week rather than try and learn 20, but learn those three and know them well. Because if you use them incorrectly, people look at you and say, okay, I don't understand what that person is. It's using it naturally is, I think, the very, very important thing. But what I always say to my students is kiss. I say, keep it so simple. Because to me, I would prefer that you say something simple and I understand it rather than doing something complex and then getting mixed up. And that happens to me in Spanish. If I get overexcited and I try to use big constructions, sometimes I can just get into such a kerfuffle. And I'm like, okay, what did I want to say? Actually, I don't even know what I wanted to say. So it's the same with English that if you keep it simple, you're less likely to make mistakes and is to have that simple base and then build up on that rather than try and jump straight in.
Yes, I do love that philosophy, Richard. Do you have any teaching, jumping into philosophies, do you have any teaching philosophies that you follow in your classroom?
Keep it so simple. While I have my plan made out for the student, I'm guided by them because I'm not somebody who says, okay, we have to do this. And if you ask me a question, we can't answer it. I had a student the other day and she came to me and she said, look, I know we're doing storytelling, we were doing at the moment, but she said, I really need to write a press release. And this was for the European Commission. So we started to work on that. I'm guided by the student and then I bring in the elements that I want. So I'm always a person who has been very flexible. And sometimes people would say, well, he goes by the seat of his pants. And I think that is one skill of a teacher that you have to be able to change in a minute's notice. I always work with private students, like one-on-one students. I don't think groups, unless they're all at the same level, are difficult to achieve an objective for them. Because I've seen group classes where one person is more advanced, one person talks more, one person talks less. And when students come to me, they often say that I went to an academy. I was doing group classes in my job, but it wasn't for me. So I always ask the student before I take any student on, I say, let's have a call first, absolutely free of charge, to discuss your needs. Because I mightn't be the teacher for you. I specialize with people in human resources and sales, because that's where I was working for the last 10 years, international human resources consultancy firm. You want to learn football English? Well, I can't help you with that. I mean, if you're Ronaldo or some great footballer, I'll teach you English. I'll learn all about football. But the idea is that if I can't help somebody, I won't help. And then my methodology is that I want you to speak. I mean, grammar is boring. to spend an hour doing grammar. It's just like, but when it comes up, we do it. But the idea that I want is, you know your grammar. I mean, you've studied English for 14 years in school, but it's the speaking which is the most important. So I get the students speaking and writing. And that would be my methodology, to focus on that. It's not, can you repeat these 15 words? Can you repeat these 15 grammar rules? No, let's start to speak. And as you make mistakes, if you make mistakes, well, then we'll go correct.
Those are wonderful philosophies to really follow by. And I love how you meet where your students are.
When I did my CELTA certificate, philosophies that you can follow, and there's lots of structures. But I find that sometimes you pigeonhole yourself too much. I mean, I do follow the philosophy that I'll recap on what we did last week. I'll do some sort of introduction exercise. Then we'll get into the main content of the lesson, and then we'll recap. But I don't do it rigidly and say, okay, 4.5 minutes. Okay, now we have to stop. Now I need to go into the body of the lesson for 15 minutes, 30 seconds. I mean, if somebody is in the flow, I will let them go that little bit further. If we're sitting there and they're looking at me and I'm looking at them, well, then we'll just change the topic. For me, or for any advice that I would give to any either English learner or English teacher, it's, and it sounds very philosophical, but use the student as your textbooks. Sometimes you can get a textbook, and especially the printed one, they so quickly these days. I mean, I've opened up English books and they still talk about, you know, do if you want to send a fax. And then the previous version had, you know, how to send a message by carrier pigeon. Now that's a joke. You need to look and say, okay, well, what does the student need now? We're coming out of a pandemic. Okay, so let's talk about how to get back to work and be even doing skills of confidence of getting back into the workplace and being with people. Person is too close to you. How do you say politely, sorry, would you mind to step back a little bit or need a little bit more space? Things like that. So I always try and make it practical and up to date, which you can't do with a book.
Definitely have to relate it and adapt to your students' needs, because it will interest them and you'll provide a lot more value between you and your students in the classroom.
I'll give you an example. When I was working in the recruiting industry, I was a trainer of our database system that we had. I was listening to an English class that was going on next to me from it was an in-company English class. Now, these were recruiters. So they were salespeople. For them, time is money. If they're not getting what they want, they're wasting time and they're not making money. So the English lesson was talking about, what would you buy if you went to the market in the morning? Would you buy fish? Would you buy fruit? How would you ask for fruit? And I was like, this is a waste of their time. I mean, they need to know what they need to know. The thing with English is that many people don't want to learn English. They want to solve a problem. The problem is, I want to be able to deal with international candidates, international clients, but I don't have the confidence of speaking. Now, once we can build their confidence in that, then if they want to come to me and they want to learn just general English, that's fine. But I like to give people a solution. I mean, you come to me and you say, look, problem that I have is I can't meet with the head office in London. I miss opportunities because my colleague who speaks better English talks to all the international clients. That is your problem. That's what you need to learn. If you go to an academy or you go to in-company classes, those teachers, while they're very good, are teaching general English. And that's not what you need. Because if I want to know how to change something in a car, I'm not going to study mechanical engineering for 3 years. I would prefer to do a course of 10 weeks that says, okay, this is how you replace the oil in a car or the fan belt or whatever it may be. You have a problem, I provide the solution.
That is definitely fascinating, Richard. I love how you actually meet the needs and tailor your classes to adapt to your students' needs at that moment. Do the majority of your students reside in one country, or are they spread out all over the world across several time zones? Does that pose any challenges for you?
Most of my students would be in Europe. So a lot of the students, I'd say 65%, come from Spain and live in Spain. I've had some students who were a couple of months with Italian students as well. And then I've also had students that they may be from Spain or Italy, but they were actually living in Ireland because they were working for some high profile international companies that had tech companies that had headquarters in Ireland. And they needed class. One girl who was working in recruitment, and she's actually in London. Then I had students from Central and South America. And yes, that was a little bit difficult. One student actually worked because for her it was 8 in the morning. It was 2 in the afternoon. She worked perfectly for me. But, you know, I think one of the things that teachers do have to be careful of is to make sure that I read in a forum on Facebook that somebody was saying, oh yeah, well, I have a class at 2 a.m. in the morning. And I'm sorry, I did come into teaching to be working at 2 a.m. in the morning too, because my candidate is in such a vast time zone. So I would try and keep it in Europe. If somebody comes to me and they're 6 or 7 hours ahead of me or behind me, depending on the time, I would say yes or no to them. I mean, I try to finish up at the latest at 7 or 8 at night because A, I'm tired, and B, I don't want to be working till 10, 11 o'clock at night.
Want to be fully there. Picking the right time definitely will utilize your energy better.
Exactly. It's the same that I say to a lot of students, even in Europe, I say, look, I finish at 8 o'clock. My last class will be at 8 o'clock, or my last session will be at 8 o'clock, because some say, oh, could you do a class at 9, at 9:30? And I say, look, you're going to be tired. I'm going to be tired as well. I'm not going to take your money to sit there and then both of us be tired. That's not good for you. It's not good for me.
I love that honesty. Take care of yourself. If you can't take care of yourself, how would you help anyone else?
Exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
What is one common myth about being an English language teacher that you may like to debunk?
One common myth is anyone can do this. Anyone can become an English teacher in Spain. As soon as somebody says they speak English, people say, oh, do you do classes? And you don't have to be an expert at the grammar, but I think you have to have the temperament. You have to have, it's good if you have some sort of train so that you know the general structure of a lesson. What can give teaching a bad name, especially in Spain, is that there's a lot of people who come for the summer and they say, oh, I'm going to go over to Spain. I'm 18, 19, 20. I'm just going to teach English. And then they come over and they charge €10, $10 an hour for classes. And then other teachers say, well, how can I compete against that? Because these people who are coming in and they're just maybe coming in for a year, 9 months, 3 months, are saturating the market. And this is a huge problem. So I think the first myth is to debunk is everybody can be an English teacher. I don't think so. I think a large majority of people maybe, but you have to love it. You have to want to do it. I enjoy the classes that I have with my students. I enjoy the students. I've had some students who have been with me for years because they just want to keep just improving their English, keep improving their English. There's other students who I've kind of said, I think maybe another teacher would be more suitable for you because your level is too low. I mean, I don't work with people who are beginners. I don't work with people who are elementary. I start with people who are intermediate plus because I don't want to work with complete beginners. And again, that's my choice that I decide that. So more and more with professionals who have a good level of English who just want to fine tune. Oh, another common myth that we often hear is that the teacher has to be a native teacher when you go to the side to actually learn the language. There's two sides to this coin. Non-native English teachers will have a much better understanding of the grammatical structures and the grammar than a native. And I mean, I say that as a native, because they will have gone through the whole process. They will have learned English as a second language. And that may give them an advantage in the sense that they also know the pitfalls as well. Now, doesn't necessarily mean they will be better or worse teachers. We cannot generalize. I mean, a native teacher can be excellent or a native teacher. If there's any people listening to this who are non-natives and want to become English teachers, absolutely you can. I mean, there is a niche for everyone. Because some people will say, well, I'm Spanish. I'd like to learn from a Spanish person who has learned English. And then some people will just say, no, 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 I want to learn from a native person. And that's it. If that is holding somebody back from being a teacher, I would say, no, you will find your niche. You just have to find your niche. Because maybe you will just concentrate with people from Spain, from Slovakia, from wherever it may be, and you will understand their needs. Myth of lots of holidays and you'll make lots of money. I mean, it is tough to make money as teacher in the sense that there's a lot of competition, but that's where you have to differentiate yourself. I would sooner have 2 students and charge €50 an hour than to have 10 students charging €5 an hour because I'm going to burn out. Need to consider that as well. Maybe you're not going to be a millionaire, but there is money to be made in teaching. I mean, I've never been a period without having clients. But you just have to differentiate yourself a little bit or a big bit.
Well, yeah, those are amazing misconceptions that you highlighted, Richard. A lot of our audience will definitely have fruitful. And could you tell us more about your English language business?
I could definitely. So like many people, I started off as a general teacher. And I just said, I give English lessons. The challenge with that is 1 week you could be teaching kids, the next week you could be teaching executives, the next week you could be teaching teenagers. And when you teach generally, it's the student who is actually controlling the process. So it's the student who's saying, well, look, I need this, I need this. And you don't know who you might be teaching in the next 2 weeks or 3 weeks. And I think that leads to burnout because you're like, oh my God, I need the money. I have to teach this group of kids, or I need the money. I have to teach this doctor, but I don't know what to teach him. So what I have done is I have focused in and I looked to see what I'm good at. So I was working up to last year in a human resources company here in Barcelona, and I saw the problems that they had. I know the business inside out. I mean, I know the processes. I know everything to do with the whole life cycle of candidates and clients. So for me, with a bit of thinking, it became obvious that that was the market to focus in on. So human resources, not just human resources, but people who are more senior in the human resources area. Why more senior? Because more than likely they would have more interaction with international clients or international candidates. They would probably have more interaction with the parent company that would be based maybe in London, the States. And now I've developed and I'm continuing to fine tune a program for human resource executives, team leader, senior manager, manager upwards, because these are the people who get promotions. They need to have their career path very clear, and they need to have English there, because that is what can hold them back. Because they might be excellent at their job, but if they wanted to move to London, they can't. If they wanted to move to New York, they can't, because they don't have the level of English. And sometimes they don't just have the confidence. So a lot of the teaching is a mixture, because I'm also a life coach, a mixture between coaching and English as well. So I like to combine everything, because I'm a practitioner of neurolinguistic programming, I'm a life coach. There's lots of things that I bring everything into. And sometimes this is what people need. They need confidence. They need to speak to somebody. I have one client and she said to me, I mean, I use English every day, she said, but I'm using English with other non-native speakers. So she said, I don't know if I'm speaking real English. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, sometimes we make up words and everybody thinks that the word is correct because we're not sure. Or we translate a word from Spanish and we kind of put a little bit of an English sound to it and everybody then adopts that word. And then she says, sometimes we stop and think and say, is that actually a word or did we just make it up? That can be a challenge for people as well. That's where I am at the moment, because my business may evolve. If I say, okay, well, I see that there is more need in the sales professionals, I will also work with sales professionals, but I try and say I work within the needs that my 8-week program that I do. So we're going to cover meetings, business emails, we're going to cover it. But there is flexibility there. But I'm not being dictated by the student. They say, oh, this week I want to do this, this week I want to do that. I say, look, this is what I have. This is the price that I charge. And then you can decide whether I'm the right person for you or not. If I'm not the right person for you, that's fine. Or if you say to me, oh, that's too expensive, it's fine. Position where I'm not going to say, okay, well, look, I'll give you 8 classes for 80 euros. I mean, I'm not going to do that, because we need to value our time, our profession as well.
What are the serious problems that the human resources professionals face trying to be better in their English?
I think the main problem they face is having confidence and how to express themselves in a professional way. Because I mean, I said earlier in podcast about this, keep it so simple. Okay, that's good when you're starting off, but then you come to a point where you need to be using those phrasal verbs, those idioms, to give you that position of you are in command of the recruiting process, but also of the English language. Because, you know, if you want to land this client and you have to talk to somebody from, you want to make sure that you have the language, the level of language that they want to know that you are professional. I mean, in Spanish and Italian, you can definitely speak like that. But the problem is, in English, it's more difficult. So you want to make sure that you have that. The main problems they have is meetings. Meeting with their manager, who possibly is a native speaker. Meeting with international teams, or meeting with clients or potential clients. Because one of the problems, as I said, is they mightn't have the confidence to actually start to approach international clients. And then they see Jose beside them speaking away, and he's getting all the international clients. It's one of the problems. What I say to a lot of my clients as well is that sometimes we can template out business meetings. We can use a stock of phrases. A common thing that comes up is, I always use the same phrases. Good morning, let's start the meeting. How can I say something different? Or this is my next point. I want to know how I can do that. So a lot of the times, expanding the vocabulary as well, that the human resources, and in general, that I found people at quite a high level have, that they want to expand vocabulary. The other challenge that they have is that sometimes they think it is enough to do the in-company classes, or they think it's enough to keep watching TV. And again, while that is good, The example I give is, okay, Friends is a very good show to watch to learn English because the English is quite good. But I mean, can you put that into a business situation? I mean, you cannot walk into a business situation and go, hey, how are you doing? Like, Joey, it's not so professional. I mean, it's a great thing that you can use if you go to a bar, if you go to a restaurant, maybe. But if you go into business, hey, how are you doing? They're going to go, okay, this person is crazy. It's finding what works for them and making sure that they are learning the English that they need and not that they think they need. This is one of the problems of, I suppose, part of my job is to convince people of the value of learning specialized English rather than just general English, because that's what they need. I mean, sometimes people say, I want to speak English. And we have to look and say, well, it's not really what you want, it's what you need. So that's where, if I got on a call with somebody, I would talk to them and ask them about their needs. And I'd say, okay, well, what do you need? What do you want? Oh, well, I want to get promoted. Okay, so if you want to get promoted, you need to be able to communicate with. Okay, what else do you want? Well, you know, I'd love to land those international clients. Okay, so then you need to know cultural aspects of dealing with English people. I mean, one example that I always give is in Spain, they might say, let's meet al mediodía, at midday would be the translation. I always tell my students, for an English, for an Irish person, midday is 12 o'clock. For a Spanish person, it's between 12 and 3. So they need to understand that if they say, oh, yes, yes, we'll have a meeting at midday. And if they ring the person at 2 o'clock, they're going to say, well, where were you? I was waiting for your phone call from midday, as in 12 o'clock. So you have to understand that. The other thing is afternoon and evening. Here, for me, when I was in Ireland, afternoon was maybe until about 5 o'clock, and then it became evening. In Spain, they say, oh, yeah, this afternoon, I have to go to the doctor at 7. And I'm like, well, that's not the afternoon, that's the evening. So knowing even cultural things like that can be really important, that they don't realize, or me as an Irish speaker wouldn't realize when somebody says, I'll see you in the afternoon, that it could be up till 7 or 8 o'clock, depending. So lots of things like that, the HR people need to know as well. The English natives finish at 6 o'clock. They say, oh, I'll call you at 8. And they go, well, why would you call me at 8? I'll be at home. So knowing a lot of cultural aspects can be really important as well.
Yes, I really think those are intriguing challenges and also the benefits of how you can solve them. Can you tell us more about how you can provide the solution for those challenges with your training and courses?
Yes, all they need to do is sign up. The idea would be looking at the challenge and looking at their particular part of that challenge. Because I mean, they might say, yeah, I'm not very good at business meetings, but maybe what part of the business meeting are you not good at? Because maybe you're very good at doing presentations, but it is those things at the start of a meeting, the small talk, that is really difficult for them. So they get on a meeting and they don't know what to say, you know, and then there's just silence. So how do you lead the meeting? How do you start the whole process from that point to small talk? How do you finish up that meeting? That can be the gaps that are there, that they know how to talk about what they need to talk about, but they don't know the things that come before and at the end. I've seen emails that they've said, look, this is the type of email that I write. And I say, it's a little bit too formal, because you know, they're using language that they learned in their language school of how to pass a Cambridge exam. And it's very formal. You know, I wish to allude to the previous correspondence that I sent you. It's like, unless you're a lawyer, we don't speak like that. But that's what they were told is a formal. And I'm like, okay, you're not a lawyer, so stop. Those would be the solutions. Again, as I said, you know, I look at, while there's an 8-week program, it would be to look at, okay, well, what is your particular need? Okay, so you're really good at writing emails. But then when you have to speak on the phone, it's really difficult. So let's focus then on what happens if you say, give me a call at any time, and then they do call you. How are you going to respond to that? How are you going to react in that situation? Little things like that. And then one thing that can be very useful is I get my students to record them giving a presentation. And then I listen to and I say, look, this is where you need to pause. This is where you need to maybe emphasize a little bit more, because what happens a lot of the times is that they read the words, but they don't put the emotion into it. So, you know, here we are today to talk about this presentation, and it's really exciting that profits have actually gone up by 10% in the last year. And then you say, okay, well, why did you go so fast? And then why did you pause in the last year? I mean, it would be better to pause here, to pause here, to pause here. So they may have the vocabulary, but they don't have the whole flow to make it more natural. Sometimes that comes up as well. Well, how do I do that? Where should I pause? Oh, I didn't know that I should pause there. Or pronunciation, little tweaks on pronunciation. Thing, and it happens to me in Spanish, the E and the I. I mean, I is R-E, their E is our I. So then they say, like, I received something. And I go, received? Oh, you received. Okay. So little things like that, that can help. And I always say to them, just by tweaking even just the pronunciation of a word will make things flow easier. Because sometimes people will just stop and they say, recive. What does she mean by recive? What did he mean by recive? And then they've lost everything else that you've said because they're thinking on that one mistake. So the idea is to try and do that, but also to build up the confidence that if you make a mistake, it doesn't matter. You just keep going and you don't let it stop you either. Because sometimes people say, oh my God, if I make a mistake, I get blocked and I stop. So the idea is to also build up that confidence of you don't want to be making mistakes on every single word, but if you make a mistake, you just continue.
Yes, I really love how you have these various lessons specific to your students' need. Also, you have it where it's laser focused and specialized. I think those are definitely needed in students, especially today, making it adaptable and relatable in their lives.
Absolutely. You know, that's the key as well, having it relatable to their lives. And that's where I feel that I can help people in human resources because I know what they need. So, you know, when they say something to me, I know what it is. I mean, I'm not going to go off and maybe teach pilots because I won't know the language. I won't know what they need. So I could specialize as English for pilots, and then I would have to know what they need to know.
Diving into a foreign language yourself, trying exactly. to tailor a lesson for pilots when they have different needs to communicate exactly. in that profession. So exactly. that's very intriguing. What cultural norms did you learn teaching your students?
This is something that is really important as a teacher and as a student. You have to realize that, okay, maybe things in South America are more formal. Maybe they're less structured. Maybe in different countries, you have to be extremely formal when you speak with the student or when you're teaching them English, that you have to say, well, in England, they would discuss it like this or they would say this or that. And also teaching students about the cultural norms. Like, for example, I had a boss who was English and we'd start a call and I would be native. He would be native English. And then we'd have all non-native people from around Europe. And he'd start telling a joke. I would get the joke. I would understand. I would laugh. But everybody else would be like, no, I don't understand that. And then it just sets the call off on a bad foot. So, for example, things don't translate. My wife always says to me, no, your Irish humor doesn't translate into Spanish. Because I say things and she said, no, it doesn't translate. Like, but I thought that was really funny. And she said, no, it's not funny at all. Understanding that, I think, is really important from a student perspective, from a teacher perspective as well, to say you need to make sure that if I'm teaching somebody and they're based in Ireland, but they're Spanish, well, look, this is one way that you would say something which is less formal when you're out with your work colleagues. But that's not going to work if you're with colleagues who are from the States, because maybe they won't understand. I also try and adapt that then. And if there is appropriate informal slang that we can use, I will teach them it's necessary. But knowing about that and realizing that some cultures will be different. The Italians, sometimes because of the way they speak in their native language, kind of sing English a little bit so that it kind of goes a little bit quick and they don't do the same intonations as we do. So then trying to get them to slow down a little bit like that and know, well, no, okay, the word might be the same in Italian and English, but we need to change the emphasis on the actual word. So I've learned a lot from different students and from the different countries I've taught students from. And I think that also helps because you say, oh, well, that worked with Vanessa, who was from Venezuela. But the same thing isn't going to work because their work methods as well can be different. They mightn't realize that English people start at 9 and finish at 6, whereas they might start at 8 and finish at 7. So they have to take that into account. You know, don't put in a meeting at 7 o'clock if it's going to be too late or too early for your English counterparts or your American counterparts. So things like that, I think, can be very important.
Sharing those various cultural norms and also how you discuss the various formalities between cultures and how they're expressed. Have you faced any challenges, Richard, while teaching, and what did you learn from them?
Early on, challenges would have been getting the level right for the students. Now, as I said, I always insist that we have a chat beforehand. Because students will say, and I've seen people say, oh, I'm high intermediate. Oh, I'm nearly native. And then when you talk to them, it's like, sorry to tell you, but you're not. Okay, so that can be one of the challenges. I would never go in and accept a student without having talked to them first to see. Because the worst thing is if you're struggling with a student because they said they were intermediate and a beginner. another challenge is don't be the teacher for everyone, because then, as I said, 1 week you're going to be teaching kids. The next week you're going to be teaching an executive, or not, because I might say, oh, well, he just teaches kids. And then the following week you're going to be doing something else. Then you get despondent because you say, this class now with that student and blah, blah, blah. So you should control, you should make sure. The other thing, I mean, I've been teaching online. I do everything online now exclusively. I don't do face-to-face classes, because one of the challenges before was somebody would say, will you do a class? And you'd say yes. And for example, I was teaching a couple here in Barcelona, and I think it took me 40 minutes to get out to their house. I taught them for 2 hours, 40 minutes back. Realistically, when I looked at it, maybe I was on 5, 6, 7, 8 euros an hour. With a just, if I calculated, it's taken me 4 hours, 3.5 hours to do this, or 4 hours to do this. So even if somebody says to you, I'll pay you 80 euros for 2 hours classes, you have to think, if you have to travel, is that actually worth it as well? Because initially it may seem yes, but then you get burnout. Or for people who are still working in academies, that can also be a problem. That academy will say, oh, we'll give you 2 hours on a Tuesday, 1 hour on Wednesday morning, 3 hours on Wednesday afternoon. And then that can lead to burnout. So think about that. I mean, don't overstretch yourself, because that can be a challenge of the time management. And working online, one of the big challenges is the internet. By and large, we should all have good internet, but somebody's internet goes down, your internet goes down, forget to plug in your laptop, and then the battery stops. Or what's happened to me is my headphones have died, and then I'm like scrambling for another set of headphones. So that can all be a problem as well. For me, you know, I've seen in 5 years, or maybe it's 6 years now, that teaching online can be as effective, if you do it correctly, as teaching face-to-face, and maybe even more so. Because, I mean, I have classes sometimes at 8 in the morning, and between you and me, I literally get up maybe at 20 to 8, and I have the coffee, and I may have a shirt on, but I have my pajamas on underneath. But everything looks good. And then I have another class at 9 o'clock, and I can go straight from one class to another. I mean, the other problem is that when you're doing face-to-face classes, you know, you have to leave that buffer time of, okay, if I'm here and I have to get to here, how long is it going to take me? And with online, that doesn't happen. But the challenge is, if the person doesn't have the technology. If you're teaching young learners, the problem is that if something goes wrong with their computer, you can't just go over and help them. I do, for a friend, I do teach her daughter, but she's 11 now, so she doesn't have too many technology problems. But sometimes something will go wrong, and then I have to text her mother and say, hey, could you just have a check? Because I know she's on mute and she can't unmute herself. So that can be a little bit of a challenge. With older learners, it's the same type of thing. Sometimes it can be challenging because, for example, what I found, one or two classes I did just phone. It was just no video. And that is really difficult. Because, I mean, when you see the person, you can see when they struggle. You don't see them, or it's just on the phone. Honestly, both parties get distracted. I might be telling them something, and then I can hear click, click, click in the background. Or they might be telling me something, and then you just get distracted slightly. So I think always insist that if you're talking with somebody, you're doing a class, that it is very visual as well, which is important. And obviously with technology, with Zoom, you can just share your screen as well, which can be very handy.
And great how you would qualify your students before taking their lessons, and also just understanding the buffer time between where you have to go, time between meeting your students. You can lose a lot of money in that case.
You can lose a lot of money and a lot of time. And I mean, yes, you can say, well, you can be listening to podcasts, like your podcast, as you're traveling. But the fact of the matter is, I mean, that if you have 5 hours of classes, but you're spending 3 hours traveling, I mean, you're doing a 7 hour day, but getting paid for a 5, which can be not so great.
And issues in that case. And also, Richard, is it necessary to have a side hustle or an additional source of income while teaching English?
The answer to that, it is always important to have a side hustle, whether you are working, whether you are teaching English, whatever it may be. I'm a firm believer, and I always have been, that you always have to have something going on. Because the English market in Spain, for sure, the English market is not going to collapse. I mean, I've been increasing my prices and people are still coming to me. But it could collapse. It could be that somebody says to me, for example, listen, for the next couple of weeks, I'm sick and I can't do classes. And then you go, oh no, now what do I do? So you do need to have a side hustle. And I mean, even if you are a full-time teacher, even if you're a full-time corporate, make time to have a side hustle. Because, you know, over the last number of years and working in the corporate arena, you know, I've seen that you can work 15 hours a day. And when you're no longer needed, they don't remember those extra 7 hours a day that you used to put in and all the time that you lost with your kids. They don't say, oh yeah, no, we'll keep you on. Corporations, businesses will get rid of you when they need to get rid of you, and that's it. And then you have to say what happened. So teaching was my side hustle that I used to do just in the evenings, but really changed. And it's changed for a lot of people is with COVID, my hours got reduced in my corporate job. And suddenly I was able to take on more students in the afternoon, which I wasn't able to do before. And that's how things started to build even more. But having said that, I still have side hustles. I do video reviews of products, affiliate marketing, things like that. No matter what you're doing, you always need to have a side hustle. I mean, you have to have a side hustle on your side hustle just in case that side hustle goes, so that at least you have a side hustle too to fall back on. It's to think outside of the box. I mean, I'm moving towards putting together more self-managed courses so that I can say to people, for example, at the moment, I have a 21-day job and interview challenge that people can take, and they just go in and every day they get a new video. And it's a little bit hands-off. So I'm starting to work on that to get more income coming in on that. So if you can have automated side hustles as well, that is very good. So if you're an English teacher, you could do a 6-hour class on basic grammar. Okay. Charge 10 euros for that. And people just go in and they watch the videos and you give them exercise and that's it. But you don't have to be in there teaching them. And then for the more specialized people, that's where you start to do the one-on-one interaction because you have more opportunity to make money. So those 10 euro an hour classes become online courses.
Your point with that needing a side hustle due to whatever the market or whatever the world is happening, you definitely have to be prepared. And so I think having various side hustles to help you leverage your income in various ways will definitely help in the future.
I think it's a mindset that maybe from previous generations, it's one job and it's a job for life. I mean, that doesn't happen now. I mean, more people are moving jobs more often, but as well, more people are seeing that, oh, I was working in a company for 15 years, 20 years, and now they've let me go. Now what do I do? Even if you had something, even if it wasn't making a lot of money, if you had a side hustle, you could then put your energy into that. That's okay, this is what I'm going to do. So side hustle upon side hustle upon side hustle. You always need to have a side hustle.
You'll be one busy bee and just know that self-care, you need to put that as the forefront.
It's so important as well because it happens, I think it was last weekend, I slept until 1:30 in the afternoon. I thought I had COVID and my wife said, no, listen to your body as well because you can work your 14-hour days if you so wish, but there's going to be a toll there somewhere. I mean, something's got to break.
Well, your body will definitely signal that you're overworking yourself. And Richard, do you have any goals that you're working towards in 2022? Would you like to share with the audience?
One of the goals that I've set, and I have no idea how I'm going to achieve it, but that doesn't matter because that's not important, is to try and help 1,000 people this year. Yes. Wow. I know. Now, the thing is that even if I only get 100 people, at least it's better than saying, oh, I just want to have 10 clients this year, because at least I will push. And the 1,000 people will come through making automated courses that I can say to somebody, okay, look, you can't afford to do an 8-week course with me. Well, look, I have a 4-week course that will help you. It's totally on your own, but you get all the worksheets and I go through everything step by step. That's the major goal. Work less, earn more is another goal. Because I mean, even when I was in the corporate world, like people used to say to me, you're taking another day off. And I used to like just make sure that I would maybe take a Friday and a Monday. And people were like, you're on holidays again. I was like, yeah. So for me, one of my core values that I really feel is important is freedom. Freedom to do and to do whatever. Now I do stress because, you know, if I take a couple of days off, I see a drop in the ink. It's not at that level. And I'm always honest with people. I'm not at that level that everything is running automatically and that I have all the systems in place, but that's coming. But the idea is that, you know, that you can just walk away, that you're not saying, I mean, especially in teaching, the problem is that June, July, August, until the middle of September, certainly in Spain, are dead months because people are on holidays. People are like, nah, I'm going to the beach. I'm not going to do an English lesson. In the winter, it's kind of like, oh, what do? I'll do an English lesson because it's like it's cold and whatever, and I want to learn things. Things start to pick up again in September. December and January are slow months as well because people are like, oh, I have no money for doing anything. That, again, goes back to the side hustle idea. If you have a goal and if you can have more sort of mini courses, little cheap things that people can buy, inexpensive, not cheap in quality, but inexpensive, then that is going to help you as well with your goals. And that's where I'm pushing towards as well. And also another goal is to try and manage my time better so that I can get all these things done.
I definitely hear you. Those are really wonderful, inspiring goals. And I'm happy to be a part of pushing toward one of them, 1,000, Richard. And tell us, where can our audience find you?
They can find me on privateenglishclasses.com. That is my website. I was really lucky. I was looking for a website name for my actual private English classes. And I said, okay, what can I do? I said, I'll check privateenglishclasses.com. A book in a session or anything, it's just book.privateenglishclasses.com, and they can actually go to my calendar and they can see my ability there. They can follow me on LinkedIn as well. If they just search for Richard Butler, they should find me. I have a little icon, a little sort of graphic picture of me there, and they can connect with me on LinkedIn as well. And then if they want to see my photography, Richard Butler Photography on Instagram.
It was a humbling and wonderful experience.
Oh, thank you. And for me too. Thank you very much.
I'm happy to show.
No, thank you. And anytime you want, just let me know.
Yes.
If there's other topics that we can talk about, we can certainly, I would love to be a regular guest.
Oh, really? Okay. I would love to. Most definitely, Richard. Okay. Thank you again for coming on the show, Richard, and sharing your experience as an English language teacher. Our audience definitely appreciate your insight and experiences.
Thank you very much, Samantha.
That was an end to another show. Please visit the website at www.teachingonlineenglish.com for the show notes. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to get notifications of the next show. Talk with you soon.